to fluster on, who Cormac had realized was conducting his own silent conversation via Org during this introduction. The Major turned back to Cormac as if Gant had said nothing at all strange. "They'll maybe have something ready for us when we get there. There's an archaeological dig at the old ruins, and it shouldn't take them long to move equipment." They walked away from the Runcible facility, and a wave of memory dragged Cormac into a sudden still point as he looked around. The country beyond the AGC park bore a resemblance to earthborn moorland, with pools the colour of tarnished copper, separated by thick, sage-like growth. Distantly, the blue line of forest seemed a standing wave, frozen in approach, and behind it rose mountains of laminar stone, bearing more resemblance to something constructed than to any natural formation. Here was where many of Arn's fellows had died. Here was where Arion Pelter's quest for vengeance had ended. And here was where Aidan and Cento had destroyed the brass killing machine Mr. Crane. Though Cormac now wanted to be sure that they had done a sufficiently thorough job. Arn led the way to an area of the vehicle park not crowded with grav cars, to where the Stratocar rested, distinct from the others. It was an AGC, but more streamlined, bearing stubby wings, two fusion engines mounted at the back and underslung boosters. The doors hinged up like wings by themselves as the three approached, and shortly the men were inside, strapping themselves in, Gant and Cormac taking the two seats behind the pilots. Seeing the two of them were ready, Arn lifted the control column and, with a thrum of AG but no feeling of acceleration, the craft shot up vertically from the ground. When he pushed the column forwards and the engines ignited behind, the acceleration slammed them back into their seats. The craft still rising rapidly, Cormac noted Arn operating a sledding control so that the AG functioned at an angle to the gravity of the planet, thus increasing their acceleration even more. In the stratosphere, Arn then engaged the boosters. "Useful toy," Cormac commented when he could recover his breath. "ECS upgrading," Arn replied. "There's a lot of it going on now." "This is the first I've seen," commented Gant. Cormac glanced at him. "Seems we both need to catch up on events a bit." Silently, he then queried the Runcible AI. "Viridian, this vehicle is definitely not standard issue."
"It is becoming standard issue."
"Why?"
"It is considered a suitable response."
"To what?"
"To possible enemies."
Cormac didn't pursue that. He had no doubt that was suitable response to the threat of Jane technology getting into the wrong hands again. Through his gridlink, he reached beyond Viridian and felt the huge flows of ECS information, a sure sign of much activity, industrial and military, all across the polity. After 2 hours of stratospheric flight, Arn decelerated and brought the Stratocar down in a spiralling glide. Cormac recognised the curving chain of the Thuriot Mountains, and when they were closer, the surrounding landscape of moorland scattered with copses and forests of blue oaks and checker trees. He did not recognise the precise area where a low cruiser with a treaded excavator mounted on its back had been parked, until he actually climbed out of the car. Then he spotted the shattered trees and knew that this was where it had happened. He gazed for a moment beyond those trees, remembering that here was where he had killed Arion Pelter, then returned his attention to his immediate surroundings. There were four people waiting by the cruiser, and shortly two of them approached, male and female, both ophidapts with scaled skin, reptilian eyes, and skull crests. No doubt they also possessed folded-back snake fangs, not usually employed for injecting fatal poisons, but just the poisons their sexual partners preferred. Cormac recognized the type, and if that fact was not enough to put him on edge, their physical similarity to Draco men was.
"Where do you want us to dig, soldier man?" the female asked Arn.
He turned to Cormac, who stepped forwards. "Scanning first, then maybe some digging. You have ground scanners."
"Excavator has them."
She indicated the machine. Studying it, Cormac realized it was a robot, very probably with AI. Soil would be its essential environment. It could probably feel it through its digging buckets, its sifters, its blowers, and its washer. Almost as if this brief mention of it was all that was required, a ramp swung outwards from the cruiser, hinged down to the ground, and the excavator rolled off. Out of the corner of his eye, Cormac caught Gant dropping a hand to his holstered pulse gun. He grinned to himself. "Over here," he said, leading the way to where he remembered the camp having been located. The woman hissed something, and the excavator trundled over. "Somewhere here," but before he had finished, the excavator accelerated forwards and began digging. Cormac was about to demand what was going on when the excavator backed up to reveal an arm, then meticulously but swiftly continued unearthing the rest of the corpse it had detected the moment it turned on its ground scanners. It uncovered a second corpse shortly after, while Arn and Gant still inspected the first.
"Buried alive," said Arn.
Briefly studying the second corpse, Gant added, "bled to death." Cormac noted the burnt-out Draco Corp orgs both corpses wore, and thought about where he had seen that before. He later found the crushed remains of Arion Pelta's skull, unearthed from the foxhole in which the clean-up crew had buried him. He was unsurprised to discover later that, of a brass man or its parts, there was no sign. Upon seeing the watchers, Anderson ordered no more quavit, and instead filled a larger glass with water from the jug provided on the table. Often, of late, he was becoming recognized in large population centers, and always for the wrong reasons. Perhaps in this case, those watching him were just curious about a Rondure knight. Anderson had already received many a strange look while in this city. But over the last 20 years, he had brought to book a gang of 5 outlaws responsible for terrorizing a district for many years, as well as 3 murderers and twice as many thieves. And it always seemed that such vermin came from extended families with much the same proclivity. He placed a hand on the gun now holstered at his hip and glanced down at the other packages resting by his feet. No, he would not attempt to use these weapons here, for, having had no practice with them, he would likely end up killing some bystander. Usually his muzzle loader was sufficient for such situations, its one loud, crashing shot being enough of a distraction for him to close in and use it as a club. These 4, 1 woman and 3 men, were dressed just like gully traders, but it struck Anderson as more likely they had stolen this clothing from their last victims. Perhaps he was being paranoid, but he thought not. Gully traders were genuine humans, so did not need the sand goggles these individuals all wore either suspended around their necks or lodged up on their hat brims. Nor did gully traders carry thurial hooks, which were used by rarely encountered hog trainers, or by villains to disable sandhogs during a highway robbery. Anderson swore to himself, abruptly realizing that his eyesight was not so good nowadays. He now knew the woman, Unga Salbeck. She was the sister of Quirst Salbeck, whom Anderson had, many years ago, dragged back to the same town where the man had raped a woman, then killed her. Receiving the customary punishment for such a crime, Quirst Salbeck had been thrown into a slear burrow, where probably he had remained alive for several days, paralysed by slear sting, while awaiting the hatching of the eggs attached to the rocky walls, and then the voracious attention of the slear nymphs. As the four now began to rise from their table, Anderson felt the leaden inevitability of his past catching up with him. Unga Salbeck nodded to him, smiling without much humour. Damn, she was still as attractive as ever. "Anderson Endrick?" said a voice. Anderson cursed himself for being a fool, as three others surrounded him from behind. So much had he been concentrating on the four in front of him in the adjacent bar, he had forgotten to watch his back. The speaker pulled out a chair and sat down, placing on the table a carbine similar to the one contained in the bag at Anderson's feet. The other two remained standing, their large assault rifles held across their stomachs, their gazes fixed on the other four, who, after a muttered exchange, now carefully retook their seats. Anderson noted that the three surrounding him all wore the same style of clothing, hip-length jackets with some sort of armour woven into the material, cloth trousers with similar armouring over the thighs and knees, heavy steel toe-cap boots and peaked helmets. This was the kind of attire worn in a foundry, but Anderson knew the purpose to which it had been adapted. He allowed himself to relax a little.
"Yes, I'm Anderson Endrick."
"I hope you know that freelance work is frowned on in Golgoth. If you have come here to collect a bounty on someone, you can forget it. Everyone within city limits comes under my jurisdiction. No one touches any lawbreakers but my men and me. Of course," he glanced over at the four, "if you are aware of any who might have committed capital crimes elsewhere, they will assuredly be ejected from the city. And what happens outside city limits is none of my concern."
"You are police?"
"That is one description."
"Your name?"
"Kilnsman Gyral." "Tell me, Anderson Endrick, are you considering committing violence in my city?"
Out of the corner of his eye, Anderson spotted Turgle coming out of the shop, and he did not miss the weapon the boy now wore at his hip. He just hoped that Turgle would keep his cool.
"I'm not considering committing violence," Anderson said slowly, getting his thoughts in order. He then carefully added, "unless it's to defend myself."
It had occurred to him that here was one way he could escape a certain piece of his past.
"I don't much like the look of them," said Gyral, gesturing with his thumb. "What are they?"
"At a guess, I'd say they are thieves. Going further, I would say that the woman is probably a relative of one called Quirst Salbeck, rapist and murderer.
it was a lie and the truth, and could get him into all sorts of trouble, but what the hell? He would be long gone.
I don't like that sort in my city.
Gyril stood, taking up his weapon.
Perhaps I should go over and have a cautionary word with them.
Perhaps you should, said Anderson. Tell me, Kilnsman Gyril, how long have you been shadowing me here?
Ever since LaForge ran you in from his roadhouse. I've long known that those are the places to watch.
Anderson nodded. I'm getting old then. I never saw any sign of your people.
Comes to us all, even Rondure Knights,
Gyril smiled.
Where do you go from here?
The Sand Towers, then out on the plains.
Gyril nodded towards Turgle, who had paused indecisively 10 meters from the table.
Then teach the youth to watch your back. Unless they do something stupid, I'll not be able to detain these four for long.
Anderson grimaced, but decided not to comment on how Turgle might not be the best choice for guarding his back. Gyril moved to go, then paused.
Strange rumors filtering down from the plains. Are you involved in that?
What kind of rumors?
Strange creatures? Nomads changing their routes to avoid certain areas. Like I said, rumors.
Dragons?
That was your word, not mine.
Yes, I'm going to take a look.
Take care, Knight.
I will.
Anderson stood up as Turgle now approached. It was definitely time to leave town. Chapter 7 Augmented. In popular usage, augmented has now become distinct from boosted. To be boosted is to be physically augmented, either by chemical or nanostructural surgical means. To be augmented is to have taken advantage of one or more of the many available cybernetic devices, mechanical additions, and distinctly cerebral augmentations. In the last case, we have, of course, the ubiquitous org, and such back formations as orged, orging in, and the execrable all orged up. But it does not stop there. The word org has now become confused with auger and auger, which is understandable considering the way an org connects and the information that then becomes available. So now you can auger information from the AI net and a prediction made by an org prognostic subprogram can be called an augury. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Ambient temperature was rising rapidly, and with his grub-like heaving along the ground, Cento realized he would not reach the survey ship before his motors started seizing up again, or one of the huge rocks that kept raining down crushed him finally into the ground. But even with all the carnage around him, lava sleeting through the acidic air, pyroclastic flows pouring down from the distant caldera, and the continual earthquakes, he did have a line of sight to the vessel, and could still use his radio. His brief query elicited no reply. The chance that there was someone alive there, but unable to use a radio, he considered remote. Then, linking to the ship's computer, Shaden had never bothered to replace it with an AI, he descended into code as he gave it instructions. As a pall of smoke cleared, he saw that those instructions were being followed. Vessels such as this one were used for orbital survey as well as landing, so contained robot probes. These devices were made for sampling atmosphere, limited surface scanning for mapping, and the occasional retrieval of airborne or spaceborne objects. Centre observed a rear port opening and the probe sliding out to hover beside the ship. It was elliptical with a sensory head mounted on its front end, and the six grasping arms folded underneath it complemented its beetlish appearance. Smoke veiled all again, but the link remained, and Cento could feel the probe coming towards him. Soon it penetrated the smoke, a sleet of lava pattering its upper surface. It drew closer, bucked when a large lump of semi-molten rock hit it and bounced off, but kept on coming. Such devices were rugged, but hardly made for this environment. Cento was relieved when it finally drew to a halt above him. The golem reached up and gripped one of the probe's arms. It folded down two more arms and with three-fingered claws gripped one of his hip bones and his neck. Then, with a thrum of AG, lifted him from the boiling ground. Quickly it turned and flew back towards the ship, depositing Cento at the last by the open airlock, before turning to head back to its launch cache. Cento observed the two incinerated corpses lying nearby, then began dragging himself inside the ship. There he pulled himself upright and tried to close the lock, but something had destroyed its mechanism. He dragged himself to the cockpit and hauled himself up into the pilot's chair, where, after strapping in, he tried to use the ship's more powerful transmitters. Nothing. No contact with the carrier shell. So, no way to link through to the U-space transmitter it had on board. Unsurprised at this lack of response from the shell, Cento initiated the lander's auto-launch. The computer refused, of course, because of the open airlock. Cento paused, then put it offline and took hold of the joystick. It would be a rough ride. But then, he was used to those. The virtual image he constructed was of a sphere of glowing points, all linked by spidery lines to a central nexus glowing brightest of all. That was the network, the entity of Draco Corp orgs, suspended in grey void. Reality bore little resemblance, for the station orbiting the red dwarf was like a thick coin 5 kilometres across, spiked and glittering with sensory arrays and with a 1/2-kilometre-high docking tower protruding from its centre. Few ships were docked there, and fewer still occupied the surrounding space. Skellor wondered if ECS was even aware that this station, placed for the long-term study of this carnelian star, was no longer entirely theirs. The query he received from the Runcible AI contained there certainly gave the impression that this place was still Polity property. Working through the Vulture's systems, he responded, giving a false identity for his ship and for himself, both of which would be impossible to check in less than a Solstan month, should the Runcible AI feel any need. "Ruby Eye welcomes you, Trader Skolan," the AI began over comm.
"Glad to be here. It's been a long journey."
"And the purpose of your visit?"
"Probably alcohol poisoning. I've been too long in this tin can."
As this exchange drew to a close, Skellor could feel the Runcible AI probing the Vulture for information. But the ship's responses were his own, for his subversion program had certainly found and killed every last shred of personal identity the ship's AI had retained. When the link finally broke, he flew the Vulture towards the tower and his designated docking station, slowing and turning it at the final moment into that framework. Buffers extended and absorbed the last of the ship's momentum. Then four universal docking clamps swung in towards the ship from above and below and gripped it with large gecko adhesion pads. An embarkation tunnel then telescoped out from the tower, groped about a bit on the hull of the Vulture till it eventually found the airlock and connected. Skellor stood up from the pilot's chair and turned to regard Mr. Crane.
"Now, time to go to work."
Crane swept up his toys and pocketed them. Skellor could not resist another probe inside the golem, for he was learning from a mind filled with disconnected but bloody memory, that Mr. Crane was very good indeed at the profession to which he had been perverted. Retroact 8. It was night, and in the shallows that lay beyond the channel excavated into the seabed alongside the jetty, pearl crabs gleamed like underwater stars. Striding out along the gritty strand, his pulse rifle propped across his shoulder, Evans thought Alston was overreacting. The pelters just did not have the firepower to come in here mob-handed. Maybe they had more men than the 200 guarding this island, but they would not be as well trained as Chaldor's mercenaries or Evans's own men. "Clear here," he said into his comm unit. It seemed pointless to eyeball the beach, when no craft could come within 20 kilometres of the island without being picked up on radar. Yes, they might come in underwater, but that way would be unable to bring in anything to deal with the autogun emplacements set into the mountainside below Alston's fortified home. By air was, of course, out of the question, as that would bring polity monitors in here quick as blade beetles. "There's a small cat about 15 kilometres out," Chaldor replied. "Tell your men to stay alert."
"What's it doing?"
"Nothing as yet."
"Probably just an otter hunter."
Evans glanced along the beach, to where two of his men were invisible in the low scrub of creosote bushes just back from the jetty. He had groups of five men, spaced at intervals of 100 metres all around the island. All of them were bored with waiting and itching for a fight, but he suspected there would be no fight here, and that the final showdown would be in Gordonstone. He turned from the sea, intending to head over and speak to his men, but just then, out of the corner of his eye, spotted something in the water.
"What in hell's name?"
He swiveled and peered directly at the object. At first, it appeared to be merely the top of a post, revealed by one of the quick ebb tides generated by the fast transit of the moon Sereb. But it kept rising as it headed inshore till a rim became identifiable. It took a moment for Evans to admit to himself that what he was seeing was a large, wide-brimmed hat. He lowered his pulse rifle into position by his hip and set it whining as it topped up the charge in its capacitor.
"What is it, Evans?" Chaldor asked him over comm.
"A hat. With a head underneath it."
Evans felt his skin crawl as the huge man rose higher and higher out of the waves. He wore no breathing gear, and his skin looked rubbery, false. Had Semper actually been telling the truth? Evans pulled his flare goggles down over his eyes, and as soon as the man was out to his waist,
He fired. The goggles prevented the strobing flash from blinding him, thus allowing him to see the flames and the glowing impact of each shot in turn. But the big man just came on.
Shit! Semper was telling the truth! We've got one big fuck golem coming ashore!
Evans fired again, holding the firing button down. Suddenly, the golem was up onto a ledge and taking huge strides through shallows scattered with pearl crabs, leaving milky footprints behind as he crushed the myriad creatures. Evans turned to run back towards his men. Perhaps more firepower might... Heavy, thumping tread behind him. He couldn't believe it. This was wrong. Too quick. Evans's men heard the scream and turned, just in time to see the golem discarding something ripped and bloody. They came out of cover, confidently aiming their pulse rifles. Retroact ends. Guilt, Mika found, was an unfamiliar and uncomfortable emotion for which her life coven training had ill-prepared her. And now she felt doubly guilty. She reached out to touch a finger to the hard field that overlay the chain-glass window and found it slippery to the touch. Beyond the window, the asteroid was held central in the vast containment sphere by grav plates generating anti-gravity mounted all around the sphere interior, countering the minimal gravity of the asteroid itself. In the intervening space, the vacuum swarmed with machines and suited figures, skinless golem and complex telefactors operated by the Jerusalem AI. Already, Jerusalem had separated the bridge pod of the Occam Razor from the surface, and sometime hence it would eject the asteroid into space in order to destroy it with an imploder missile. "He will not be pleased," she said. The voice that replied was mild and conversational. "But then you didn't need to shout when you were a demigod."
Ian Cormac's requirement for an expert in matters concerning the Jane and Dragon is not of prime concern. His singular mission is to catch and or destroy a criminal. Our concern is to contain and understand a technology that could obliterate the polity. Your abilities, as you surmised, will be more usefully employed here.
Mika turned and surveyed the quarantine pod she had been allotted, with its intrusive scanning gear and the huge cowled surgical robot poised over a slab with drain channels around its edges, and felt a sudden lethargy overcome her. The nerve blockers and analgesics were not so effective now, and soon it would be time. Whether or not she would survive was open to question. The reports received from the medical team on Masada told her that Apis had not yet revived, and that they were still removing further mycelial growths from him. But on the plus side, he had not yet died.
"I've uploaded the recording of the operation," she stated. "I have," Jerusalem replied, "studied it in detail, Acelis Mika, and will be able to make some improvements. Presently, I am designing T-cell nanobots for the finer work."
Mika gritted her teeth and asked, "Will I be clear then?"
"This method has a good chance of success. Disconnected filaments of the mycelium will not be able to transmit defensive information to each other, And so, the nanobots should be able to destroy them. They will work in the same manner as the counter-agent still being used to rid Samarkand of the ceremal-eating mycelium there. Disconnected filaments? The mycelium is killing you, so immediate surgery is necessary. However, I am capable of more invasive surgery than you performed on the outlinker, so I should be able to remove more of it. Mika shuddered. She wasn't usually squeamish about such things, but she did not intend to ask the AI just how invasive it intended to get. The result, she suspected, would look rather like an explosion in an abattoir. Might it not have been better to have Thorn here as well? The procedure I am about to undertake can also be carried out aboard the Jack Ketch. Thorn can then be kept in cold sleep until such a time as the nanobots can be conveyed to that vessel. Jerusalem paused. There is, Mika Acelis, no further reason for delay. Mika knew she was procrastinating, and was doing so because she was scared. She discarded her robe, walked over to the surgical slab, and sat naked on the edge of it. It was very cold. As she lay back, and the surgical robot raised a nerve blocker to her neck, she thought that perhaps, like Thorn had intended, she should have had a memplant installed, so that the step over death and into artificial life would be available to her too. But it was too late for that now. On the Jack Ketch itself, with two analgesic patches on his chest and a nerve blocker now numbing his leg, where earlier it had felt as if the mycelium had taken a hacksaw to his hip bone, Thorn limped out into the corridor adjoining medical and thought, how weird. This seemed more like the inside of some old Renaissance chateau than a high-tech warship. What with the carpets, the plaster mouldings on the ceiling, the ornate dangling light fittings. But more disconcerting was that none of this stuff had been here a couple of hours ago, when he had entered medical to be checked over. The drop shaft was reassuringly high-tech, however, though it shifted while he was in transit. Gripping the handles fitted at his departure point, he stepped out at an angle onto the floor of the bridge. Momentarily, the changed angle of gravity fields disorientated him, and the fact that seemingly nothing stood between him and starlit vacuum was disconcerting. He lowered his gaze to study the bridge's strange decor, then its other occupants. Just as Jack said, "He will speak to you momentarily." Cormac was pacing the rug, obviously angry. Gant lolled nonchalantly, with his shoulder against one of the cast-iron street lamps, while Jack's mechanical avatar sat in one of the club chairs, an ankle resting on one knee, the fingertips of each hand pressing against each other to form a cage below his chin, his eyes invisible. Thorn went over to join his friend.
"This should be interesting," Gant muttered.
Thorn made no comment, his gaze straying to the antique execution devices for which Jack seemed to have developed a penchant.
"That's a new one,"
he pointed out a big brass statue of a bull. Gant glanced over.
"The brazen bull, particularly nasty. It's hollow, and the victim was placed inside to be roasted. They put reeds in its nostrils to alter the sound of the screams,
so that it seemed the bull was bellowing.
"You know," said Thorne, "I'm glad I don't live in any system run by humans."
"Fucking A," said Gant.
Just then a shape appeared, apparently turning above them in vacuum. A ring, composed of a jade-green serpent swallowing its tail. Ouroboros. This acted as a frame for something that appeared first as a distant silver dot, then grew to fill the frame, and finally came through to block it from view. An androgynous face, bald and metallic, with shadowed hollows rather than eyes. This was a projection, not something actually outside the ship. Thorne and Gant fell silent to observe.
Cormac looked up.
"Jerusalem?"
"The same," the face replied. Without any more ado, Cormac said, "I went to Masada specifically to collect Mika, since I require her expertise." The face tilted, as if its unseen body had shrugged.
"Certain other factors have come into play, Ian Cormac. Not least, my own requirement of her taking precedence."
Cormac grimaced. "I was given carte blanche by Earth Central, which presumably you have been allowed to override, and presumably for the best of reasons, so I'm not going to argue the point. I would just like an explanation."
"Simply put," the AI replied, "we have decided that understanding Jane technology is more important than apprehending one criminal who happens to employ it. Skellor is certainly dangerous. Any separatist with a gun is dangerous. Do you go after said separatist, or do you go after the arms trade?"
"The answer is simply that you go after both, but that the latter must necessarily take precedence."
"A very elastic analogy," said Cormac tightly.
"There are the other factors I mentioned."
"Do go on."
Jerusalem continued.
"Acelis Mika will shortly undergo major surgery, without which she will die. Once I have carried this out, I will place her either on life support or in cold sleep suspension, whilst one of my sub-minds removes stray, regrowing and possibly mutating Jane filaments. Were she aboard the Jack Ketch, the same scenario would apply. She would have been useless to you."
Hearing this, Thorne wondered if his insistence on not going with Mika but boarding the Jack Ketch had been such a bright idea.
"But then she's useless to you as well," said Cormac.
"For a period of 5 to 10 days, by which time I will have designed an nanofactured robotic T-cells capable of hunting down and destroying all remaining Jane structures inside her. Obviously, Jack could employ such nanobots, but your search for Skellor, debouching from Viridian, is most likely to be either on the line or out polity altogether."
Looking uncomfortable, Cormac nodded.
Relentlessly, Jerusalem continued, "Then the likelihood of my being able to convey some medium containing those nanobots to you is remote, as that would have to be done through the Runcible network.
Yeah, okay.
It is also well to remember one other point. Acelis Mika herself believes she will be more usefully employed aboard me.
Cormac remained silent, his look of annoyance fading to blankness as he folded his arms.
"Thank you for your explanation," he said coldly.
The head nodded once, then slowly receded and winked out. Briefly, the Ouroboros reappeared, like a call sign. Then it, too, faded. After a pause, Cormac turned to Thorn.
"You heard the prognosis for Mika, so the same probably applies to you a few days down the line."
Thorn straightened up, trying not to wince at a stabbing pain at the base of his spine.
"I heard it."
"You can take a shuttle across to the Jerusalem." Thorn snorted.
"What would I do aboard a ship like that? I'd rather be in cold sleep here."
Cormac nodded, then turned to the ship's avatar.
"Jack, take us under."
Immediately, the stars and the blackness folded into a deep grey, and Thorn still experienced a frisson at that strange tugging feeling that told him they were on their way.
"And while we're here, Jack," Cormac continued, "let's see what our dead separatist has to say."
Despite his pain, Thorn had been fascinated to learn that this ship possessed its own ghost. He stared as a line of distortion cut through the air outside the drawing room. With a clicking, wickering sound, the automaton Jack shut down, its head bowing and the glint dying behind its glasses. It must have been too much trouble for the AI to maintain simultaneously both the automaton and the projection of Afrin that now appeared. This was not the woman of whom Thorn had seen images. That woman had been contemptuous, angry, frustrated at no longer being able to fight. In other words, human. This Afrin was something else entirely. She was naked, but naked or otherwise, Thorn doubted her bones had originally been visible through translucent flesh. She was colourless, her hair long and pale, whereas Thorn distinctly remembered it being brown. Her skin was white as milk, whereas before it had carried a slightly Asiatic hue, and her eyes were a demonic, pupilless black. Thorn could only wonder if this was the result of some strange kind of vanity, for surely, appearing this way, she could be whatever she wanted. Also, the woman was drifting, like a corpse in deep water, her hair and arms pulled back and forth as if by wayward currents. There was a sound, too, like delicate wind chimes or a tittering giggle and a distant moaning.
"Hello, Afrin."
Cormac walked over to the edge of the carpet. She turned and focused on the agent, though Thorn knew that this was all illusion. The woman would be seeing him through the camera eyes Jack allowed her. Thorn glanced at Gant, then stepped away from the lamppost to stand at Cormac's shoulder. Curiosity was growing inside him, as thick and heavy as the Jane nodes that were already there.
"Hello, agent," Afrin replied.
Cormac seemed at a loss. He parted his hands as if to encompass that same loss, then brought them together and got straight down to business.
"You told me Skella is hunting dragons," he said, "but I think I can safely assume that we're not talking about the winged and fire-breathing kind."
"Dragons and brass men," Afrin replied, and tilted her head back as if laughing, or as if in pain.
Thorn saw then that the woman did possess some colour. The inside of her mouth was bright red.
"Well, I know about the brass man. He collected what was left of Mr. Crane on Viridian only a short time ago, and that's where we are now heading, in the hope of picking up his trail. Do you know where he's going next?"
"Dragons."
Cormac appeared to be chewing on something bitter. "But where will he find them?"
"Give me substance," said Afrin.
Cormac slowly nodded. "Yes, I'll do that, when I think you're no longer holding anything back. My other option is to let Jack take your mind apart, piecemeal, in order to find what I want. Though, after taking that course, I'm not sure I'd bother asking him to put it back together again."
"Cruel," hissed Afrin.
"You are merely a dispensable recording. But, more pertinently, you are a criminal under sentence of death."
Thorn absorbed that. Not so long ago, the guilt of a cerebral recording was a murky legal debating point. Now, all recordings of murderers made after the murder was committed came under the same sentence.
"I have paid." In saying this, Afrin changed, aged 100, 1,000 years in a few seconds, became something twisted, with flames issuing all around her. Ignoring this display, Cormac asked, "Why did Skella want a smashed metal-skin golem?"
"Pleases him. Angry when I mocked him. Burnt me."
Afrin's illusory form was growing young again, the flames dying away in the air around her. "From what I've seen, I don't doubt he has the ability to rebuild Mr. Crane, but because it pleases him?"
"It pleases him. Please him.
Love him." "Do you know where he is heading from Viridian?" Thorn now observed Afrin grow old again, then, in a moment, young.
"Completion. The symmetry. Aesthetically pleasing."
"Answer the question. Where is he going? Where is the dragon sphere he is hunting?"
"I love you. I love you. I love you."
Afrin was oscillating between extreme age and pubescence, and a halo of flame remained surrounding her. Cormac turned to Thorn and Gant. "Is there anything either of you would like to ask? Maybe you might get some sense out of her." Gant spoke up. "What did he do to you?" Afrin was now floating a meter from the floor. Her gaze swung down towards him.
"Skellor!" she hissed.
Something then snapped inside her, and she tilted her head back, opening her red mouth wide. A cycling wail issued from her, and she began to slide back away from them. Abruptly, this movement accelerated, and she hurtled along above the deck and disappeared through the invisible wall.
"Maybe some other question would have been better," suggested Thorn.
"She said she'd paid," said Gant, looking directly at Cormac. Coldly analytical, Cormac said, "Yes, I see. What would it be possible to do to a person if you could control the function of that person's body at a nanoscopic level? Nerves, skin, bone and flesh could be rebuilt, even as they were being destroyed." Thorn added, "She said he burnt her. I wonder for how long." He winced, pain not being something he could distance himself from right then. Cormac turned and stared at the wall, a grey void. "Jack, should we erase her?"
That is your decision, but I would advise against it, the disembodied voice of the AI replied. She has suffered, but with time and effort can be restored. She may possess much knowledge about Skellor, and much insight.
Without Mika, said the agent, that might be something we'll need desperately.
Well, if you fully understand the danger, then I cannot dissuade you, said Anderson, knowing that the sister of a killer coming after him had only increased Turgle's fascination. It was harmless enough. The danger Unger Salbeck represented held no threat for the boy.
Golgoth was to the right of them now, and ahead numerous trails tangled into the sand towers. This was not the usual route taken away from the city, which lay on the other side, but Anderson hoped thus to avoid encountering Salbeck's sister. He had intended to depart from the lower city directly underneath the platform, but LaForge had advised him against that, because apparently the area of the towers lying below the Overcity was swarming with nasty creatures, some of them possibly human. Here, but for the occasional Sulabane plants standing with their woody frills and brackets like petrified dwarfs in ragged clothing, the ground was barren. The coloured sand eroded from the layers had been trampled by the passage of many feet into a mixture of nondescript grey. Raising his monocular, Anderson turned aside and studied the Overcity of Golgoth. Its 2-kilometer-wide platform, as well as resting on the buttes themselves, was supported by steel pillars and arching trusses. In the shade thus engendered, there was movement amid scattered, bulbous dwellings made of bonded sand. The Overcity, with its rectilinear towers, domes and spires, resembled an earth city that Anderson had once seen in an ancient picture. He panned his monocular around to face the buttes directly ahead. He could distinguish falls, certainly caused by the recent quakes, and above them could just make out the occasional sinister shape of a slear skittering across the high faces of sandstone or in and out of the caves bored into it. The creatures were small, but it would be best to keep safely to the centre of the paths.
"If you ever had to kill a third-stage slear?" he suddenly asked.
"They don't have a third stage," Turgle replied.
"Ah, they are rare where you come from, but not so rare where we are going,"
Anderson pointed.
"Those are all first stage, little more than nymphs. They're cave hunters, mostly, and for that purpose possess a feeding head with grinding mandibles with extensible antlers, 10 legs attached in pairs on independently rotating body segments, and though quite capable of killing a man, they never grow larger than 1 meter in length. Also, like their adult kin, they possess the ability to split themselves in two, but there's no necessity for that, as they're not breeders."
"I know what they are," said Turgle, giving Anderson a puzzled glance. Anderson continued regardless.
"After about 2 years, they encyst in the sand and transform to the second stage. The front segment folds up and melds into the feeding head. The 2 legs attach, turning into carapace saws for dealing with larger prey outside the sand caves. Prey they can now see, because they simultaneously gain a nice triad of compound eyes. They also grow an oviposited drill, which
they can use to inject paralytic, and at this stage they grow to about 2 meters in length. Turgle grunted, then shifted about in his saddle. He asked, "What's an ovipositor?" "It is the egg-laying tube protruding from the rear of an adult sleer." Turgle turned to him.
"There, you see, adult sleer. So why do you talk of a third stage?"
"Because there is one." Anderson considered all he had learned during this journeying, and all he knew about sleers and their life cycles. One day, he would write a book about it all, to add to the collection kept in the Rondure Library. But not yet. Not while there was still so much to see. He continued enthusiastically, "The second stage creature, as you are aware, splits itself for mating, each half moving on 4 legs. The rear section can then go off to mate with the rear sections of other sleers, while the feeding or hunting end continues about its business, the 2 sections still communicating by low-frequency bioradio. Once rejoined after mating, the whole creature lays eggs in a cave or burrow in which it will dump paralyzed prey. Nymphs, first-stage sleers, then hatch out and feed on this preserved food. After many years, and for reasons I have not yet fathomed, a second stager again insists and transforms into the third stage. These lay eggs in a similar manner, but out of them hatch second stage sleers.
What are they like then, these third stage creatures?
Bigger, inevitably. The first one I killed was 3 meters long. Its carapace was dark gray, rather than bearing the usual sand-colored camouflage, and another pair of legs had ridden up beside its head to form pincer arms that act just like that punch axe you carry. And, of course, it now ran on 6 legs. It did that. Anderson pointed to the rim of his sandhog's carapace, where 2 large puncture holes had been filled up with a web of the epoxy strips normally used to shoe a sandhog's feet. Turgle observed this damage silently. Then his gaze slid up to the long case fixed further up the carapace.
"How did you kill it?"
"Not with that. I got that later." Anderson waved a hand at the case. "I hadn't